Hello and welcome to the very first episode of the Hope Illuminated podcast, your source for the stories, science, and strategy of suicide prevention and mental health promotion, where we live, learn, and work. I am your host, Dr. Sally Spencer Thomas, and I am on a life mission to empower communities with solutions that help people overcome isolation and despair and rekindle a passion for living. Each episode, we are joined by international experts to inspire hope and offer real guidance. Welcome to the show. I am so grateful you are here. Today's show is really going to be focusing on the question, why are men so lonely? And what can we do to help them create connection and community that can potentially be life-saving, if not just life-enhancing? And as many of you know, this really poignant question has come to me as a passion of my work out of the tragedy of my brother's death by suicide in 2004. And I truly believe that if my brother had another peer, someone he had vicarious respect for in his circle of business connections and friends who was out sharing a similar experience of living with a mental health condition, or someone he felt he could be vulnerable with about his suicidal thoughts and feelings, if he had that kind of place to land and be connected, I really believe that we would have had a much better chance of having him here today. So I'm very much invested in this conversation of how do we connect men in a place where they feel supported and empowered in some of the darkest times of their life. This quest led me to connect with some awesome partners here in Colorado. Cactus is a full-service advertising agency based in Denver. And our partners at the Office of Suicide Prevention with Jared Heinman at Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, the three of us got together and put our heads together and said, what's missing here? Why are so many men falling through the cracks and not getting support or professional care that they need when they're fighting for their lives with addiction and other mental health conditions like depression and bipolar? And what we came to the conclusion was it wasn't so much that they needed more services, although I would argue we need to do a better job in providing services to men who are challenged by these things. It wasn't that so much as they weren't even reaching out at all. It wasn't like they were reaching out and not finding things. It was that there was so much conditioning for so many men, especially men at highest levels of risk, not to admit weakness or brokenness, not to ask for help in this way that they couldn't repay it back. And so they were just kind of white-knuckling it through some really difficult things and often succumbing to this overwhelming psychological pain and finding that that was better than being a burden to the people who loved them. And so the three of us got together and we did some research and development, asking men who had survived their own suicide attempts, interviewing experts like our speaker today, looking at the people who surround men in crisis and asking them, how do we reach you? Where do we find you? What do we need to do to get you through and get you to the other side when you're facing this? Or even better yet, how do we prevent you from getting into this level of despair where this looks like, you know, the only way through? And that landed us with Man Therapy. Mantherapy.org is a new way of doing proactive men's mental health through compelling and humorous media outreach. Radio PSAs and posters and coasters and billboards and so forth, all intended through our creation of a fake therapist, Dr. Rich Mahogany, to pull men into the conversation and bring them into our website portal, mantherapy.org, where they can self-assess for depression, anger, substance abuse, and anxiety. And then we can triage them based on what they're interested in or where they're saying they're having challenges into various resources that we've pre-vetted to be, you know, man-friendly. We also have specific resources for male first responders and male veterans. And our outcomes so far show that men are really engaged, at least the men that we're trying to reach through this campaign are really engaged with this experience. So without further ado, I want to introduce our expert today, Dr. Thomas Joyner, who is an incredible international thought leader on this topic. And I'll never forget the first time I met Thomas. He probably has no recollection of this, but it's ingrained in my memory forever. It was my very first experience at a national conference with the American Association of Suicidology, and it was 2007 in New Orleans, and I had just gotten there. I'm only like a year and a half in my grief journey, So this, and I'm all by myself, I don't know anybody there, and I go to Thomas's pre-conference, and I had just read, without putting down, his book, Why People Die by Suicide, because I really wanted to understand my brother's emotional pain and try to have some insight into what could lead people to that state. And I had just read it, and it was just on my mind, and I felt like the biggest fangirl, and I'm unabashedly so, Thomas, you know, got him to sign my book, and I have followed his work closely ever since. In fact, every time we meet up at a conference, I always like to have, you know, my coffee or cocktail time with Thomas to pick his brain about what's coming down the pipe in the future, because I always know his bold and paradigm-shifting ideas will really change the way we think about things and move us in a direction that's actually really going to make a difference. So the things you need to know about Thomas, his bio is far longer than I'm going to be able to share with you today, but just know it's incredibly extensive and amazingly impressive. He has a long, long list of peer-reviewed journal articles and books. The ones that are most related to our conversation today are Lonely at the Top, The High Cost of Men's Success, and Why People Die by Suicide. These books are incredibly well-researched, but they're also well-written, so that they're very appropriate not only for the professional community, but also for the lay community to get their heads wrapped around these issues. He's Princeton educated. He's received a ton of awards, the Robert O'Lawton Distinguished Professor from the Department of Psychology at Florida State University is one of the most prestigious awards. He's been a consultant for NASA. He is part of a $70 million project with the Military Suicide Research Consortium, and he's been aired on all kinds of major media, including the Wall Street Journal, Times of London, NPR, Talk of the Nation, and two appearances on the Dr. Phil Show. So without further ado, I'd love to say hello to my friend and colleague, Dr. Thomas Joyner. Welcome, Thomas.
Thank you for having me, Sally. That was all too kind. And it's my pleasure to be your friend and colleague.
Fabulous. Well, I would love for my listeners, many of them who have not heard you speak before, kind of understand a little bit of what has brought you into this work. And I think, if I'm correct, one of our shared experiences on this journey is that we were both in the field of psychology when our loved ones died. And so if you could take us back to that period in your life a little bit and kind of what that was like for you in your experience of that tragedy, but also how it kind of crystallized your passion for this work.
Yeah, the tragedy that you're referring to in my case is the death by suicide of my dad. That occurred in 1990, and as you mentioned, I was already in psychology and already interested in research on mood disorders and suicidal behavior. But despite my sort of growing knowledge base at the time, I really didn't see my dad's death coming at all. And when it happened, I mean, the main reaction, of course, was great, great shock and great pain and great misery. And that lasted for quite a while. But what also emerged pretty quickly from the aftermath was a resolve to do something about this. That comes in a lot of different ways. But one of them was a lot of the narratives that had been told to me in a very good graduate program were totally wrong. And I knew them to be wrong, because they didn't fit my dad. Things like, you know, suicide's weak, suicide's cowardly, suicide's selfish, and on and on and on, none of which applied to my dad. And so I knew there was a problem, and I resolved then to devote, you know, most, if not all, of the rest of my professional career to trying to prevent this from happening to other families. It had already happened to mine. It was too late to help us, but I was determined to help others not go through this.
Thank you. And that's totally borne out in your work. What continues to fuel your passion there? Are there other things that have come into play that kind of keep you inspired and engaged? Because I know for many of us, the long haul is hard to kind of keep that going. What else gets you to kind of show up every day and do this work?
Yeah, for me, keeping an eye on the eventual long-haul result, namely a reduction or even an elimination of suicide deaths, that's very inspiring to me. And so I definitely keep my eye on the long-term One way I do that on a daily basis is to train future scientists who are going to go on after I'm gone to train in their own right future scientists. And if that keeps happening over the course of generations, well, then I trust that we're going to solve this, you know, within decades. And so I'm very optimistic about that, and the way that I, you know, sort of live it every day is to train these amazing PhD students who gravitate to PhD clinical psychology programs around the country, including the one that we're running here at Florida State University.
And having worked with a couple of them now in some research projects as we've been doing collaboratively, I can tell you that you've got some of the best and the brightest, and they are doing some incredible work in helping answer some very difficult questions.
Sally, I was just going to add that there's little doubt of that. They're amazing. They're the lifeblood of everything that we do around here. And they're very hopeful because they're in their 20s now, and they're going to be productive on this question for decades to come. And they, in turn, are going to train people just like them and so forth and so on.
Right.
That part of it makes me very hopeful.
And you've done a lot of work with the military and veterans. Can you speak to kind of how your journey led you in that direction?
Yeah, it's like a lot of things in life. There's a lot of serendipity there. You know, my work on suicidal behavior in general had just started to become well known at about the same time that the suicide rate in the military started to climb. And as is understandable, the military's initial reaction was to try to handle that problem internally. And I understand that, and I respect that, actually. What I also respect is that they quickly understood that was a mistake and that they needed help. And so when they realized that, to their credit, they reached out beyond the military to civilian experts, and I was one of them. And just through that consultant role, what emerged was the idea for the consortium that I now lead together with my friend and colleague Pete Gutierrez, who's at the Denver VA. And so that's a little bit about how that military connection evolved and developed.
Great. And you've been able to do so many really, high-profile, really interesting and important work. Do you have one or two professional highlights that stand out for you that you're like, wow, you know, I was so honored to be a part of that, or this piece was really, it had a big impact on me? Anything that stands out for you?
I'm very fortunate to say that I could really kind of go on and on about that. I mean, anything my students accomplish at a high level is really what I take the most pleasure in. For just one example of that, the theory that I've developed on suicidal behavior is described in the book Why People Die by Suicide. And that book was written just by me alone, and it was written for people in general, for just folks in general. It wasn't a scholarly, scientific, theoretical statement. I did that 5 years later in 2010, with several of my PhD students in the lead. And so to see that article come out in this journal, it's called Psychological Review. People won't know this, but what it is, it's the pinnacle outlet for theory statements across all of psychology. And so to get something in there once is a major achievement. For my students to have done it in the lead is very satisfying. So that one stands out. You know, we mentioned the Military Suicide Research Consortium. That's an ongoing effort and achievement that I'm proud of. There are a few others, too, that I could point to as well.
That's nice. We'll put some of these into the show notes as well so people can kind of get a sense of all the ways that you've been able to influence our work and really influence a lot of people's lives. So let's pivot a little bit and get to the nuts and bolts of our conversation today, which is really about men's mental health, in particular, you know, about this phenomenon that we're seeing, in the public health data about men in the middle years, and this increase in what what the media have labeled the deaths of despair. So while other populations are getting a little healthier and living a little longer, men in the middle years are dying sooner and often from things like addiction and overdose and suicide, and it's really driving this increased mortality in this age group. Can you talk a little bit about your thoughts on some of that?
I mean, I think the main question about it is, why is it happening? Because if we know that, then we know more about what to do about it to combat it. And I don't think that question has been fully answered, but there are some leading suspects in terms of, you know, the culprits at play here. And, you know, I would mention a couple or three, and certainly one has to do with the substance use arena. And that's true of all substance abuse, alcohol. But what we've seen in the last 10, 15 years or so becoming an epidemic kind of thing is the opioid crisis.
Yeah.
And that's really hurting our efforts to decrease these deaths of despair, including suicide. But I would also point to changes in society structure, family structure, et cetera, that have decreased our sense of connections to one another. I mean, we as a species are just a very social and gregarious species, and we need each other. And forces lately have been, if anything, driving us apart. And that also has just proven a great challenge to those of us who are passionate about suicide prevention. I mean, it's almost like swimming upstream. You know, just as we're starting to make progress, I think, on theoretical fronts, on clinical fronts, et cetera, we have to swim against the tide of opioid crisis, social disintegration, some other factors too. And so if we could just kind of get beyond those, I think the progress might start to kick in and be more visible in terms of the rates. Now, social disconnection, loneliness, it affects everybody. In fact, it's a very powerful detriment to any aspect of health, physical health, mental health. And it's certainly a powerful determinant of suicidal thinking and behavior. And that's true of any human. It's just that there are certain subgroups who, for a lot of different reasons, are just more vulnerable to becoming socially disconnected and lonely than others. Men more so than women by far, and middle-aged and older men more so than younger men too. So it's that middle age.
Can you talk about a little bit of your thoughts of why that's the case?
Yeah, it's that middle age, older subgroup of males. I mean, I think there are, again, numerous sources for this, but one, the main one that I tried to lay out in the book, Lonely at the Top, is that early in life, there's already a tendency for males to be less socially engaged. You can actually even see it postnatally at about 6 months. Baby boys will look at images of faces, people interacting with one another. Baby boys will look at that kind of stuff less than will baby girls, whereas
wow.
baby girls will look at that stuff. The baby boys will look at geometric shapes and the like, even at that age. So there's already a little bit of a difference in infancy. Now, that difference, though, gets mitigated by the school structure. It's hard to stay socially disconnected. I mean, it's certainly people vary in childhood and adolescence on their loneliness levels, but the school structure really does mitigate that because it throws everybody together.
Right, the sports teams and Cub Scout groups and, you know, various ways that we structure that socialization.
And just literally being – exactly, and just literally being forced to sit right next to someone else in classrooms day after day after day mitigates those loneliness forces or processes a little bit. And so I think men, much more so than women, start to take that for granted, that you don't have to really work at friendship. It just kind of happens to you. It doesn't. It's not something that you do. It's something that happens to you. Women don't tend to view it that way as much. And I think that's to their credit and to their benefit. They understand it's more like a garden, where if you don't work at it, garden's not going to thrive. If you work at it, it'll pay off. And I think friendships are very similar to that. And the men just don't absorb that lesson, and so it starts to hit them as age progresses into the 30s, 40s, 50s, and beyond. The garden starts to die, so to speak. Friendships start to fall away, and they're not actively replaced. And even for a successful man, you end up, and certainly for one that doesn't feel successful at all, but even for successful men, you can end up 55, 60, 65, and have no friends at all. And that's a dangerous situation, I would argue.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much research that social support not only affects our mental health, but all kinds of health issues. So it's dangerous on a number of levels. Can you speak to that a little bit more as well?
Sure. I mean, there's something about it that really gets into our skin, into our cells, into our brains, just the being with other people. The way I think about it is we evolved over the course of eons, and all we had was each other. The system that's inside of our skulls evolved with inputs from touch, you know, looking into each other's eyes, all the time. And so now, if that system gets deprived those inputs, and it used not to be possible to deprive the system of those inputs, but now it is, because you can get your socializing done without touch, without really looking at somebody's eyes via, say, social media and the like. And so I think that's not helping things. But the flip side of it is, if you do get a dose of social connection, it really has a tendency to get under the skin and be positive and helpful. And then beyond that, if you just have connections, you tend to have more access to things like good health care, tips about how to take care of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
If you have friends who notice that something's the matter with you, they're more likely to say, hey, what's wrong? Why don't you go to the doctor? Maybe drinking too much, you know, it's things like that. Whereas if you're isolated, you don't have any of that.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking here, like, I think your previous point about the opiate addiction and the substance abuse issues is probably incredibly connected to this experience of loneliness. First of all, it kind of numbs out the pain of it, but also, I've listened to people in recovery. They talk about their relationship with their substance almost as a substitute of a relationship with a friend, and also sometimes those situations facilitate maybe superficial, but still some kind of social contact, whether going out to the bars or, you know, using together or whatever. Can you talk about the interplay between the substance abuse issues and the loneliness?
I view it as a little bit complicated. I mean, definitely at the extreme ends of substance misuse, mm-hmm. there's no doubt that it's pernicious for all the reasons that you said.
Mm-hmm.
It can spoil relationships. It can drive people away. It can waste money. It can take over somebody's life to where they don't really care anymore about doing the work of maintaining relationships. It's all about the substance. The place where I think it gets a little more complicated is at the other end of the spectrum,
mm-hmm.
of substance use, not necessarily
right.
misuse, but use. Where I think for some people, their neurobiology is such that they just shouldn't have any substances involved in it at all. It's just not a good fit. But for others, I think low levels or moderate levels of engagement in, say, social drinking, I actually think that's a facilitator to social connection
mm-hmm.
for some people. And so I'm careful about, you know, being rigid about insisting, you know, with patients in psychotherapy, for example, I'm cautious about being rigid about abstinence. Because I think for some people that's actually a little bit of a facilitator for social connection. But got to make careful judgment calls about when somebody's starting to cross a line from,
right.
you know, adaptive use to maladaptive use.
Or if that's the only place they're getting social connection, right? They're not doing outdoor activities or sports or showing up at their faith community or whatever. Like, that's the only place they're connecting. I think that would also be limiting in terms of types of relationships.
Right, and that would be one way to make that judgment call is you know, if the substance is sort of the alpha and omega of everything for them, their friendships are all through that, their activities are all through that, that's probably concerning, whereas if it's just one piece of a larger, you know, mosaic, that's probably towards the healthy end of the spectrum.
Can you comment a little bit on some of the racial, ethnic, and geographical variability in kind of the men in the middle years phenomenon? Because it's not true for all races and ethnicities, or all places of the world, for that matter.
Well, focusing on the U.S. for a moment, it's really prominent among Caucasian men, you know, 45 plus, is where a lot of this despair kind of, you know, behavior and death is really getting focused, is in that demographic. And that's kind of the bad news. The good news is that there are ethnic groups who are somewhat protected from this phenomenon. It's pretty much everyone else except Native American people are protected, Caucasian people, Native people being the most at risk. The lesson that
what
I take
Asian
from that
American?
I think they're intermediate. Mm-hmm. There's protection in the social structure, where older people tend to be treated very well and very respectfully. I think that's a protective buffer for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's those kind of things that I think are hopeful, because we can learn what's going right with certain ethnicities and then try to borrow some of that and benefit from it for ethnicities for whom things are not going right, like the Caucasian men 50 plus.
And say a little bit more about why some of these other groups might be protected. You mentioned that in some communities, the elders are respected for their wisdom and they have that kind of value within their community. Are there other things that we can learn from for some of these other groups that may have some protection?
I think that the common thread, it tends to be family connections are richer,
mm-hmm.
and more frequent and more commonly face-to-face. Community connections, similarly, often it's through religious institutions, but not uniquely through religious institutions, but a lot of it can definitely take place there. Those are richer, those are more valued, those are more frequent, and you know, certainly almost all face-to-face. I really think that's the essence of the difference, is that in certain subgroups, they've just drifted too far away from that really, you know, basic, ancient sense of personal face-to-face connection frequently that, you know, we used to be sort of just part of being a human 100 years ago, certainly 500 years ago, 5,000 years ago. But now things are more complicated, and it's not necessarily all to the good.
Yeah, exactly. At our last little meeting where I got to pick your brain, I asked you about some new work that you're publishing on kind of this self-sacrificial personality, and how, thank goodness, we have folks who are willing to put their lives at risk to help their community, right? Our first responders and our warriors and construction workers, for that matter. You know, I have a big interest in kind of industry and how that lines up with suicide prevention work. Can you talk a little bit more about that, kind of some of this new work that you're doing?
Sure. I would preface it with the caution that it's pretty speculative at this point.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, just like we did with the theory statement that ended up in the journal Psychological Review, my students and I were able to place this paper on self-sacrifice, some of the evolutionary roots of that and of suicidal behavior, also in that same journal in 2016. And the point we tried to make there, and again, it's speculative, but we observed that there are really pretty fascinating commonalities between what happens in the non-human world when individuals of certain species self-sacrifice on the one hand, and then what happens with humans when they die by suicide. There's actually some intriguing similarities. For instance, in all cases, the individuals tend to be highly aroused in the sense of they're agitated, they've got signs mm-hmm. of irritability, of anger, of aggression. That's a commonality. Another one has to do with social withdrawal, mm-hmm. removal of oneself from the social milieu. That happens in those non-human social insects and other species too that have this kind of thing of self-sacrifice.
Can you hear a little bit more about your animal research discoveries? Because I was like, Thomas, where do you find this research? You must read everything under the planet, because you always come up with some really intriguing findings. Can you just talk a little bit about, like, some of the insect findings and so forth?
Well, I've always been impressed by the social insects, just because of they're just fascinating in and of themselves, but for many reasons. And one reason is that they have a really astonishing array of self-sacrificial behaviors. All of them are fatal to the individual, and all of them are specifically undertaken only when it will be a net benefit to the community. The individual's life is lost, but more than two copies of that individual's genes are saved in other individuals who are saved by the first individual's self-sacrificial behavior. Mm-hmm. And in insects, they do this in multiple ways, but an amazing one that I'd only learned about within the last few years is that they have a sack with an internal sack of noxious, it's like it's kind of sticky amalgam, and they can, under the threat of predation from other insects or animals, they can immediately restrict or contract rather a muscle around the sac, and it explodes the sac. It sends this noxious substance all around the area. What that does is it kills the individual, but it also saves any other individuals in that vicinity. I think that's amazing that even exists. And not only that, but it exists across different social insect species. So I've been interested in that for years, but I used to not pay too much credence to it in terms of a connection to human suicide, just because we're so different than the social insects. But then I learned that there are actually non-insect species that do exactly the same thing, including a mammal. This mammal is called the naked mole rat.
Oh, right, yeah.
And there's a species of shrimp that do this. And so that got my attention, that this kind of thing has cropped up in multiple branches of the evolutionary tree. There must be something to it, and that led me to wonder whether there's some connection of that to suicide in humans. And what I've come down to thinking is that we have that same ability in us to self-sacrifice on behalf of others. And that actually is adaptive, admirable. There are cases when it's heroic, as in the cases of firefighters or soldiers in combat, police officers. You can think of other examples too. But what I think suicide is a misfiring mm-hmm. or a derangement of that otherwise adaptive behavioral module that we share in common with the social insects, with naked mole rats, and with some other species too.
Thank you. It's always so fascinating to hear kind of where those connections line up and what you're learning from to inform human behavior. I think that, well, I know that because I published a paper on it, that your book, Why People Die by Suicide, is one of the top theories, the whole theory of it, and paradigm shifting our field and thinking differently. And I realize that many of our listeners aren't familiar with that. Could you summarize that model and also talk about, because you published that book in 2006, I believe, right? The evolution of your thinking since that time and so some of the research that has maybe nuanced some of your ideas, your original ideas.
I mean, the general idea of the theory hasn't really changed much. It's mm-hmm. it's a three-factor account. The idea is that although people who die by suicide are just as different from each other as they are, from others, as we are from each other, there's a lot of human differences between just people, just folk. And that's true of suicide decedents, too. And so there's tremendous variability, but the idea is that there is one commonality that they all share, and it's the intersection of three factors. And two of those three are pretty obvious and intuitive. The idea is that if you feel like you're a burden on others to the degree that your death will be worth more than your life to them, then you'll have a state of what we've called perceived burdensomeness. And then when that combines with this sense of disconnection, loneliness that we've been talking about, that puts people in a place where they become suicidal in thought. They have desire for death. They're having suicidal thinking. But, and then here's where the theory gets a little non-intuitive or novel. there's a big difference between thinking about suicide on the one hand and actually enacting it on the other. So that's the part that's kind of intuitive, but the third part is the part that's not quite as intuitive, and it's the insight that thinking about suicide is one thing. Enacting a thought about suicide is quite another, and the reason that there's such a difference is it boils down to the role of fear. Even desperately suicidal people will often get very afraid of what they're about to do in the moments, in the minutes, even the hours before their planned suicide attempt. So afraid that they're deterred and that they're prevented from suicide. Luckily, tragically, not it. We all right?
Yep, I just said thank goodness.
Yeah, exactly. And tragically, on the other side, there are people who are able to fight through that fear and die despite the fear. And that's been a big focus of the work, is to understand how it is that people do that rather remarkable thing. I don't think it's an admirable thing, but I think it's a very remarkable thing. And understanding how it is that people manage to do that has been a pretty key insight of the work. So putting it all together, when those three factors, fearlessness about death, feeling like you're a burden, and feeling lonely and socially disconnected, when those three intersect, according to this theory, then that's when these tragic outcomes are most likely. You asked about changes in my thought over time on these, and there really hasn't been a whole lot, to tell you the truth. I think what I articulated back then, I'm not going to say it's right or it's wrong or it's this or it's that. But whatever it is I wanted to say back then on those three factors, I said it. And I haven't changed my mind. And the research has been very supportive of actually continuing to believe in those factors. We've just meta-analyzed the entire literature on the theory. To date, there's been about 150, mostly published, some unpublished studies, from around the world. And that's what, of course, a meta-analysis does, is it takes all those studies and pools them into one big study. And we did that with the theory studies. And, the support for the theory is pretty robust. And by the way, that's yet another...
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to add that that's yet another thing that it's just been a pleasure to sit back and see my PhD students at FSU run with, because they're the first authors of this paper that we hope to publish in the pinnacle journal for that kind of paper, which is called Psychological Bulletin, though we're not quite there yet. We'll see.
So I remember when the book came out and we all ran off to read it. This, one of the things that really excited us is because it was so parsimonious. It could explain so much with just three things. And I remember you saying it's really powerful to explain why female physicians have similar rates of suicide as female prostitutes, even though those are two very different populations. Can you talk, maybe give us a couple of examples of where people have tested out this theory with two very different populations of men?
Well, sure. I mean, the one thing that comes to mind are some of my students have gone from here at FSU to become professors at other places. And one example that pops to mind is Tracy Whitty, who Auburn just promoted and tenured. That was the right decision that Auburn made. And what she did was to look at these things in veterinarians, reasoning that if you're a veterinarian that has to do a lot of euthanization of animals, your fear of death might be lower than if you don't do a lot of that kind of stuff in your veterinarian practice. And sure enough, that's what she's found. Another student, Aaron Fink Miller, who has gone on to do a lot of the work on physicians, showing that this capacity is higher in physicians, this capability, this fearlessness of death, which stands to reason, because to be a physician, you can't be afraid of those kind of things, because you see them every day in your patients. The idea is that if a physician develops the wish to die, he or she is going to be particularly lethal, because he or she has the fearlessness of these things and also knowledge about capability of method. So those are just a couple of examples of light that this theory sheds on very well-known phenomena like the male-female difference, the occupational differences between physicians and others, etc., that this theory sheds light on, whereas past theories didn't do as well on.
Has anybody looked into differences in sexual orientation or gender expression?
Yes, we've got a paper, for example, in press, or it might be out by now, in the Journal of Abnormal Psychology. I keep harping on this, but the empirical, pinnacle journal for our kind of work empirically is the Journal of Abnormal Psychology, and this paper is in that pinnacle outlet, again led by my PhD students here at FSU. And what we found is that especially the desire variables, the variables of feeling alienated and feeling like you're not contributing or like you don't get a chance to contribute as much as you deserve, that kind of feeling, you know, similar to the desire variables from the theory of perceived burdensomeness and thwarted belongingness, those really are very relevant for those populations, very salient in those populations.
So are some of the papers you just mentioned, the veterinarian paper, the physician paper, this paper, are they publicly accessible? Is that something I can put in the show notes, or have they been summarized somewhere?
Yes, they all, in every case.
Would you send me the link so I'll put them in the show notes? Maybe.
I'll figure it out. I'm just trying to think. I just don't know if I have the links handy for all of them, or the PDFs. I might have the PDFs for them.
We'll find them. All right, let's pivot to this last section here on, okay, really compelling and important research here. What do we do with this? How do we practically apply this? And I'm going to start with a series of questions going from 50,000 feet down to the individual. So let's start at kind of cultural and systems level. Given what you've learned about what's missing or what's driving men into these spaces of despair, what can we do, at the systems level, in workplaces, in healthcare systems, in education, that can maybe shift things and start to make a difference to prevent some of these outcomes based on your research?
Well, it's a challenge. I don't pretend that the research program has produced any far-reaching solutions on that front yet. I would say a couple things. One is that the traditional approaches, have just not been adequate. So it's pretty clear we need innovation. What you've done on man therapy is a good example of that, where, it was a departure from the status quo. It was done in the knowledge that what we had been doing just wasn't clicking with most men. And so I think that kind of thing is very exciting and innovative and promising. But we probably need more than that. My own view is that something like this much of a problem, this much of a plague, we have no hope of solving it without science. And so I'm very concerned about any anti-science sentiment that's expressed around these things, no matter what quarter it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be a huge mistake, and I'm very concerned about that. It's as if we were trying to solve cancer without science. It's just not going
right.
to happen. And the same thing here. It's just not going to happen without science. Now, we need partners. No question, we need partners in community mental health, in government, in people with lived experience, and people who have been bereaved. We definitely need the energy and the insight and the help and support of all of them. No question about it. But without science, it's hopeless.
Yep.
That's my agenda. Really, is to keep my nose to the grindstone scientifically. And I don't get distracted by much of anything from that. And I insist my students are there shoulder to shoulder with me doing it too, so that they can carry the baton forward over the course of generations. And if we do that, I think that's the end goal. I think we can get there. Without that, though, we're not going to get there.
Absolutely. And I feel like my role is to be the connector and the translator, because I value all of it as well. And I feel like I can help doing what we're doing right here, taking the research findings, translating it to communities that can enact them, bridging the gaps, bridging the perspective differences between the different partners on the project, and trying to build bridges. So you're an incredibly valued partner for me, and we've done some things together, I think, that have bared that out. Let's go to a different level. Let's talk about what you want to share with some of our mental health service providers and just generally the mental health community. What should they be learning from this research that they might be doing differently, either in their outreach or in their clinical services?
I mean, I think in the clinical community at large, there remains fear, concern about working with suicidal patients. I'm amazed to say that in 2017, but it's definitely still true.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an outrage on the one hand. On the other hand, I kind of understand it. I mean, if I didn't feel trained or prepared to do anything, I wouldn't necessarily want to do it. And so what I think that means is a message for mental health professionals that in order to equip yourself to do this work, it actually is not that difficult. They're really clear assessment targets to focus on. There are very clear behavioral and cognitive and pharmacological methods to target those factors. And if you just do that week in, week out with suicidal patients, that's a good standard of care right there. And the vast majority of patients get better on that. That's a rewarding thing to take someone from mm-hmm. at risk of death down to, you know, less. You've saved that life, you've saved that misery, that anguish, and you've saved it in dozens of people that would be devastated by that person's death. And then when you multiply that across the caseload, I think that's pretty rewarding. But I do acknowledge it's challenging, but what do you do in the face of challenge? You prepare, you train, you equip. And if that were a huge undertaking, okay, I understand the reluctance, but it's really not that huge an undertaking to prepare for this. I mean, I'd point to my work on that mm-hmm. In terms of assessment targets. I would point to work in terms of clinical technique that David Rudd has led on brief behavioral cognitive therapy, that, of course, Marsha Linehan has led on dialectical behavior therapy, that David Jopes has led on the collaborative assessment of and management of suicidality. Those are pretty useful techniques that can be picked up upon by a seasoned clinician very quickly and deployed to the benefit of those at risk for suicide.
And so for my next layer of questions, which is what can families and loved ones do based on your research, one of the things that you do is as men are getting connected to care, kind of, you know, call them out and ask them if they've been trained in these methods, if they understand them, when's the last time they've got training, how comfortable are they feeling working with someone who's suicidal, and really do kind of a customer analysis of what they're, you know, signing up for to make sure that the person that they're working with is feeling more competent and confident than maybe your average clinician. So that's my next level. What can families or loved ones, friends who are worried about men, what can they do based on the things that you've been learning?
I mean, the encouragement of quality health care and quality mental health care is a piece of this puzzle. It's not the only piece. That alone is doomed to failure. We've seen that already. We've tried that alone, and it hasn't worked. But that doesn't mean we should stop doing it. I think it means we should step it up and then complement it with other things that are also parts of that puzzle. Also I think, you know, a consumer mindset is more and more on the rise among healthcare consumers, including mental health care consumers. If a particular provider is not equipped or trained or prepared to provide the state-of-the-art care for whatever the issue may be, in this case it's suicidal risk, well then I would try to find another one who is. There are ways that are intermediate between the at-risk person and face-to-face care, intermediate by which I mean things like 1-800-273-TALK as a resource, a way to get support and also information about suicidality and maybe what to do about it. Yourmantherapy.org, I think, is a similarly useful resource. So those are things that I think are intermediate that are helpful pieces of that puzzle. As a society, I think we're making slow but noticeable progress on the destigmatization of suicidal behavior and of mental disorders, and I think that's encouraging. I wish it were faster, but it is progressing, and that's only going to help. We do need help, though, I think, in reversing the tide against us. Right now we're swimming upstream against opioids, swimming upstream against social disintegration. And until those tides turn a little bit, I'm just concerned that we're going to be swimming upstream for a while.
Yeah. With the friends and family question, one of the things that comes to mind that I know is a huge factor in kind of the sense of purposelessness and isolation is the experience of separation and divorce, especially, you know, both for men and women. Can you talk a little bit about what friends and family might do with someone to support them through that transition based on kind of some of these findings and thinking?
To me, one key is persistence in reaching out.
Mm-hmm.
And this happens actually after every kind of separation. I've never studied this, but I've developed kind of my own anecdotal rule of thumb that when somebody's bereaved, not just by suicide, but otherwise too, when they're bereaved, I make literally a note in my calendar to make sure I contact them on day 8. And that sounds kind of arbitrary, but I do that because on day 1, support tends to rush in. Same with day 2. But at day 3, it starts to recede. And then by day 4, 5, 6, or 7, it can feel pretty lonely all of a sudden. And so I make a note to contact them on day 8. Because that's when they might be at a low tide, so to speak, of social connection. And I think that same logic can apply to any number of separations in life. And it just means that you know, reaching out immediately, of course that makes all sorts of sense, but I think the real key is persistence across time in terms of reaching out to people who may need it, who might need it for any reasons, divorce, separation, bereavement, job loss, whatever the case may be.
So my last question is really about the man who is experiencing loneliness and despair. You know, I hate to put the onus on the person who's suffering, but sometimes there are things, there's some insights perhaps that we can provide for people that can give them some inspiration for self-advocacy or to change a direction. What would you say to that, to maybe a man who's listening who is experiencing some of that now?
I guess I would start with the path of least resistance. And what I think that is whoever that man feels able to talk to about things that are hard to talk about. And, you know, for a lot of people, that's going to be a best friend type figure. For a veteran, it's often going to be another veteran. For an active duty service member, similarly, another active duty service member. And just to, you know, especially if that individual has some literacy, some mental health literacy, to be able to get to the person in need and tell them, you know, what you're thinking about, well, all the fears that you have about engaging in health care, mental health care, those are unwarranted. Or at least they're exaggerated. They may not be fully unwarranted, but they're exaggerated and the benefits are going to outweigh the costs. Sometimes it's a clergy figure that people are comfortable with, and that can be life-saving for someone to, you know, open up to a clergy person who also happens to be pretty literate in mental health. Certainly that can be a primary care physician, a family physician. So that to me seems to be the key, is getting that risk person in tune with somebody like that they'll actually trust and that they'll actually listen to. As a supplement to that, I think all the resources that I've mentioned already are a good supplement. 1-800-273-TALK, mantherapy.org. Some others too. I think those are great supplements, actually. But really, to me, I think I view them mostly as supplements. And the main thing would be that connection to a trusted person, family member, clergy, best friend, veteran, active service duty member, whatever the case may be.
Thank you. All right, I'm going to kind of summarize our conversation, and then I'm going to come back to you, Thomas, for some last thoughts and then some closing remarks. So just kind of looking over our last hour, we started with the story of your father's death in 1990 and having our shared experience of being in the field of psychology when we lost our loved one, and how that sense of resolve to do something. I often say that you made resolve to go war against suicide, and your weapon was going to be science, and you have proven to be one, if not the most prolific researchers of ever, I believe. I think you really hit home when you talked about noticing how the narratives of suicide are just often dead wrong and often getting in the way of what we need to do to provide compassion and advance this field. And so I'll turn to that, the book of Myths of Suicide, also for our listeners if they're interested in seeing how you have systematically dismantled each of these notions of things like suicide is selfish and so forth. I loved how throughout the whole conversation you lifted up and really expressed your love to your students and their impact, not only today, but the future of the science in this area. Clearly, your relationship with them is such a powerful part of your work, but also benefits them so much. I agree with you that the swimming upstream with the opiate crisis right now and substance abuse in general is the crisis of our time. I, too, have a family member who has been overwhelmed by this crisis, and I think with the deaths of a number of celebrities in this area related to this, it's on the forefront of a lot of people's minds, and it feels really out of control right now. So hopefully, with some of all of this work, we'll be able to make a dent in that crisis as well. The second piece, which is really the crux of our conversation, was this discussion about social disintegration and loneliness. And one of the things that I thought was really powerful was the metaphor that you talked about with women tending their garden of relationships and really working hard at, you know, checking in with people and making time with people and having that garden really thrive over time, where boys perhaps just assuming that those relationships are always going to be there, and as they get to men and start to see their friendships fall off, their garden starts to die. So I do think that's one thing that we can start to think about proactively, is how do we help men, like the Men's Shed Project or other, you know, other types of projects where men are connecting and doing really interesting and fun things together, but also maintaining those relationships. How can we bring that more to the front? We talked a little bit about the racial, ethnic, and kind of geographical diversity and variability in some of these things and what they mean and what we can learn from some of the communities that are protected. We talked a little bit about the kind of the self-sacrificial personality and the role in society and kind of evolutionary why that might be so in some of the animal kingdom research that you cited, and what some of those signals that they're giving off behaviorally, how those also translate to human behavior like agitation and social withdrawal. We reviewed your model of suicide risk and how that can really not only inform who's at risk, but also what our prevention efforts might need to be in terms of helping people find purpose and connection. We then need to kind of drill down, okay, now what? Now what are we going to do about this? And at the cultural level, you really made a call for innovation, things like man therapy and other things that, you know, we just got to try to do something different to see if we can move the needle, but to never abandon the science behind it. Bringing new partners in, like people with lived experience or community mental health, and testing new bold ideas that are coming from the grassroots, but then really evaluating how can we make them better? Are they really having the outcomes that we want them to have? Loved your call to our fellow mental health professionals. Do not be afraid, or find ways to be less afraid by getting training and preparation so that you can do the honorable life-saving work of working with people who are suicidal, and that you can find it rewarding and something that you look forward to rather than being scared all the time. And I'm going to put all of your recommendations for those different delivery models into the show notes. To friends and family, let's look at and get to know some of the tools that we can use to help their loved ones, and let's have some persistence in reaching out in number and in time, because people might not always be receptive on time 2, but maybe by time 10, they can kind of welcome your support. And then finally, to men who are lonely, you know, find someone to share with a peer, someone you trust, and so forth. So final thoughts, Thomas, and then I'll just wrap up with a couple of closing comments.
I guess I would conclude by reminding everyone that a clear-eyed understanding of what suicidal people are really going through is going to position us to really understand their anguish and get us in a spot where we're determined to do something about it to reduce it or to eliminate that. And all these misunderstandings about how this is selfish or that's weak or it's hopeless or any of that kind of stuff is just wrong, contradicted flatly by science, clinical experience, et cetera, et cetera. And so getting our positioning and our messaging right about how it really works and what people like in that boat are really going through, I think is going to increase determination and compassion both to do better about this and to reduce suffering.
Yep, and political will. The more science we have behind us to make our case, the more people will come along with us. So thank you so much, Thomas. As always, it's just such a wonderful thing to be in conversation with you. I always learn so much. We will have a number of these resources and papers and so forth in the show notes for those of you who want to dig a little deeper. And you can always find Thomas through the Florida State University page that he has his lab highlighted on. And his books are all over Amazon. So just Google Joyner Suicide, and you'll probably get, a dozen or so things pop up, and they're all worth reading. For more episodes, please go to my website, SallySpencerThomas.com. There you'll have an opportunity to sign up for a newsletter where you can hear about our future podcasts, as well as upcoming Twitter chats. I'm actually doing a introductory contest now, so everybody who signs up for the newsletter, subscribes for the podcast, and leaves a rate and review, it goes into a drawing for a $100 Amazon gift card. And so just in closing, I always like to say, let's open our hearts. Let's challenge our thinking. Let's take action to save lives. Together, we can restore dignity and sustain a passion for living. Thank you so much.
Staples knows that when the leave behinds for your sales call get left behind at your office, it's time. When you need to print 30 pages and you're 300 miles from the office, it's time. And when the intern packed the Harrington file, not the Farrington file.
Ugh, my bad.
It's definitely time. And it's times like these when you can count on Staples. Access your files from email, the cloud, or USB, and then print, copy, fax, or scan them, and get back to business fast. Visit your nearby Staples. It's pro time.
Rush into Old Navy starting tomorrow. The entire store's on sale up to 50% off. Want to save even more? Redeem your super cash now at Old Navy and OldNavy.com. Better hurry, though. Sunday's the last day. Excludes clearance, gift cards, register lane items, jewelry, today and 2-day only deals.